Good morning, everybody. I am so glad that you are here today. Again, I'd like to invite you, if you have not already been made aware, or in case you missed it, we are having a meal following our morning worship, so we'd like to invite all of you to stay if you're at all able, spend some more time with us. We're not going to hold you hostage for very long, I guarantee you that. And I would like to do one small thing I never ask you to do while I'm preparing to give the sermon. If you are here because someone invited you, or if you happen to be a visitor today, would you mind raising your hand just a little bit? Okay, about a third of us are here because someone invited us. That's a great thing. What that shows us is that we are willing and able to share the Word of God with our loved ones, our friends, our family, those that we care about, and those just happen to walk in the building today. You're very much welcome. I'm glad that you're here today with us. What I'd like to do for our sermon this morning is look over into the book of Ecclesiastes together. I don't often say that on a Sunday morning, to go to Ecclesiastes. It's one of those books that when you get to it, if you're not aware of what you're looking at, it can be a little bit confusing because the author here designs himself to be seen as Solomon, the son of King David and the king of Israel in his own right. And he is someone who had the opportunity to dive deep into the questions of life that hopefully we've all encountered as we've lived in this world. The real idea is, what is meaningful? What has meaning in this life? What is worth our attention, our time, our finances, our resources? What is worthwhile for us to be engaged in this life? And no one is better qualified than King Solomon because he had wealth, he had popularity, he had prestige with God. He was in a position to be able to test all these things and see if they were meaningful, and to give us the scoop on what the information he learned was. And one of the things that he found in life that had meaning was the idea of friendship. Surprisingly, money couldn't buy him happiness. Wealth, women, really weren't the meaning of life for Solomon. Although the evidence of him loving women kind of goes without saying, if you know his history. But he realized that all of that was not the meaning of life. It didn't give us a foundation of truly appreciating the time that we have here. Instead, friendship is one of those things that he found kind of on the edge of his main conclusion about God being the center of life, the one that has meaning in our world. Friendship is mentioned in a very positive light. And so if we go to Ecclesiastes chapter 4 together, verses 9 through 12 is his own kind of side paragraph in the text about the benefit and the blessing of having friends. If we look over in this passage, we're going to see five things specifically that Solomon mentions of why friendship is a good thing. Hopefully you've all experienced that friendship, having people you can rely on, people that you're close to, those are blessings. But here Solomon tells us five reasons why friends are so nice to have in this world. Over in Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. Now, the Hebrew word here for reward is a little bit more precise. The idea is defined as a benefit, wages, payment, salary, or here's our key phrase for this morning, a return. And so we use that phrase, a return, usually in regards when it comes to money, when it comes to an investment. And so one thing that we can say about the idea of friendship, having people that we're close to, is we are investing in that relationship with them. A return on a financial investment is one that we're probably all familiar with. The same thing is definitely true when it comes to an emotional level, when it comes to this idea of friends. Really, when you think about what I do for a living, it's a little bit complicated and a little bit uncomplicated when you think about it. My profession, my job, my role as a minister of Christ is really about forming relationships, getting to know people, sharing my life, my experience with them, and hopefully they share the same thing back to me. And so it's difficult for someone with my personality type to really have a lot of relationships with a lot of different people, these friendships. But what I tend to do is heavily invest in just a handful of people. And those unfortunate people have to know a lot about me. And one of the things that I do is I open up my mind, my heart, my experience with you publicly. Whether you want to hear it or not, you have to listen to me at least a little bit, at least pretend to, right? And so the idea of investing time, information, and being vulnerable around a lot of different people is a part of life. So what is it then that we tend to invest in when it comes to this kind of relationship? Well, the first thing is communication. Again, talking with people, sharing with people, opening up with people. That's a part of the job. That's part of the role of bonding with someone else. We also invest the idea of help. If you've got a friend who asked you for your help and they're really your friend, you should want to help them. And even if you don't, you probably should if you want to keep that relationship strong and healthy and so on. Also, one of the most important things that we can invest when it comes to our friendship and our relationships is time. How much time we spend with someone, how much quality time we spend with someone really shows us and shows the other person how much we think or how little we think of that relationship. And so when Solomon says here, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor, he might mean in a more practical sense you can get more accomplished and do more work with two people. But also on kind of a side note from that side note, it's an investment that we make. We put in time, communication, and help with people in the hope that we can grow our relationship stronger with this individual. Secondly, in Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 10, you can kind of see there's a theme developing here about how many verses, how many points, etc. Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 10, "For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up." Now, you know that you have a good friend if you trip and you fall on your face and they help you right up immediately. But you know you have a good friend if they laugh at you first and then they help you up afterwards. If I fall and you're so concerned about my well-being, you don't laugh first, something is wrong with our friendship, because you should know how embarrassed I feel, and you have the right to laugh at me when I fall on my face. Just a little bit. The idea here, of course, is pretty obvious. Do we have friends or do we have acquaintances? I know a lot of faces. I know very little names. I know a lot of faces from the people in this community. But when I see someone that I recognize, it usually takes me a little while to try and pinpoint how I know that person. Now, if you'll remember, we had our change for the Southeastern Children's Home event here last month. I had little cans, you put your change in it. Or if you're Mr. Larry over here, you bring your giant glass 5-gallon water jug full of coins that no one in the world can lift. Whatever you want to do. And so we took all of that money down in buckets, literally buckets, 5-gallon buckets, two of them, down to the bank. And as we were pouring in, hand by hand, these coins into this poor coin machine that broke twice, I saw this lady over at the bank counter, and she looked so familiar. And I said, "I know that lady. I'm not a member of this bank. I have no idea where I know her from, but I know her face." And so the entire time, we're there for like 2 hours waiting for this machine to not break on us. And I'm looking at her and I go, "I know that lady, but if I can't just walk over and say, where do I know you from? That's kind of odd. I want to, you know, offend her. So let me try and think about it." We sat there, thought about it, could not figure it out. Finally got all the change in there, got the receipt to get our cash to be able to deposit to the children's home. And Christine walked over to the lady, our secretary, and she said, "Hi, here's our receipt." And I go, "Hi, how do I know you?" And she goes, "I thought I knew you too." I'm like, "Yeah, okay, great. It's not just one-sided. Great. I'm not a weirdo. Great. Where do I know you from?" She goes, I don't know. And I go, "Did you work somewhere before you worked here?" She goes, "Well, yeah, at the Chick-fil-A." And I go, "That's where I know you from. I knew it. You're the manager who gave me my chicken nuggets almost every other day." And so I knew her, but I didn't really know her. And so the idea of this particular verse of falling but having a companion, having a friend, it's someone that you know will be there for you If you happen to make a mistake and fall on your face, or you can't remember their name or who they are, and you see them at the bank, that's someone that you need to get to know. In Proverbs chapter 17, verse 17, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. Family and friends are there for us to lean on when times are difficult. We keep going in our passage here, Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 11. Solomon writes, "Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone?" Now, the image here might be pretty obvious to you, but it's one of survival. Someone in a wilderness situation where body heat from one individual is not enough to stay warm in the cold weather. And so when two are lying down together, sharing this body heat, that keeps them warm, it keeps them alive. Now, in that kind of very practical sense, though, we can use that idea and translate that to our everyday relationships with friends. So we have friends to give us what we need, not just body heat in a survival situation, but we have needs that need to be met by our friends. Now, hopefully you have someone that you can lean on if you need to cry about something, even guys, from time to time. Hopefully you have someone that when you are overwhelmed, when you are frustrated, you need to vent to someone, you have a friend who loves you enough that you can just call them and just complain for a little bit. Again, not a part of our character, but sometimes it's best to come out in a safe environment. Sometimes you need a hand up from a fall, either physical or spiritual. And sometimes we stumble, sometimes we trip, sometimes we're struggling with a particular sin in our life, and maybe a friend can help us along the way and help us live a more holy life. As the old saying says, a friend in need is a friend indeed. If you have needs that need to be met, hopefully we find friends who can help us in those situations. Next, in Ecclesiastes chapter 4 and verse 12, Solomon writes, "Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." Now, this is talking about the idea of combat, obviously. In ancient warfare, there was no rifle. There was no shotgun. There was no artillery. There was a group of men in armor with hand weapons lined up against other men in armor with hand weapons. And so you would learn quite quickly or suddenly that if you did not have an army, did not have ranks protecting you to protect one another, standing alone in combat is not going to be very successful. I don't know why this image is in my brain, but whenever I think about a veteran situation, a military situation in which you have people looking out for one another, I think about Forrest Gump. I don't know why. My brain does not work like most brains. I'm pretty much aware of this. But I think about good old Forrest Gump in Vietnam with his back up against Bubba. And they just leaned up against each other, and they said, "I'm going to watch this way, you watch that way, and we can just lean on each other." And that little image in my mind of Tom Hanks and Bubba sitting there in Vietnam in the rain is what comes to my brain when I think about the idea of having a friend to support you, to back you up in a literal sense. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13, Paul writes this, "No temptation has overtaken you except that which is common to man," meaning we all go through the same kinds of temptations in life. "But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." Now, I love the fact that this basically says that God gives us all temptation in this world to overcome. But with that temptation that's inevitable to come in this life, the way that it is designed, there is always a way out. There is a way to escape that temptation. We don't have to submit to sin, submit to immorality. We can choose that which is holy and that which is righteous. And sometimes the way of escape is disguised as having someone you can talk to, having someone, a friend, that you can say, "Listen, I'm struggling with this. If you can help me get through it, I would appreciate it." That's the idea of a friend backing you up. Over in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 24, "And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching." Now, preachers have been somewhat guilty, myself included, of using Hebrews 10:25 as a proof text for telling people why they shouldn't skip worship. And while it might be used in that way sometimes, the overall context of this passage is not just about show up or else. The overall concept is showing us the positive side of attending worship, attending the assembly, rather. The emphasis is not on show up or else. The emphasis is on you're missing opportunities to encourage, to exhort, to stir up love with your fellow Christians, hopefully your friends, if you do forsake the assembly. So keep showing up that we can all encourage one another, exhort one another, and keep each other strong going in the right direction, backing each other up on the way to heaven. And then finally here, one more thing that we see a little bit away from our context here is in Proverbs 27:17. Proverbs 27:17. "As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friends." However much we want to try to deceive ourselves, blind ourselves, fool ourselves, that our friends, the people that we spend our time with, influence us just as much as we influence them, there is a mutual influence when it comes to friendship. The people that we spend the most time around will determine really who we really are. Now, I know that Jesus spent time with sinners. He spent time with people that were considered the lower class, the untouchables of the first century day and age. And Jesus is a very special case in that way, that he's the Son of God, giving us an example. But we cannot truly, honestly expect, if the only people we associate with are people that are living in sin, that may not rub off on us in some kind of way. We want to be good influences, absolutely, no doubt about it. We don't want to kind of close ourselves off into a protected, holy bubble, as if there were such a thing in our world today. We need to be aware that the influence does go both ways and be fair and honest about that dynamic. Now, the idea of iron sharpening iron is a principle that I can relate to in a more practical way, in the sense that I have a small fascination with pocket knives. If you know me at all, Steve can attest back there, I probably love knives a bit too much. I always love the idea of having a knife for utility, for protection, even in the worst situations. And in a practical level, I buy a lot from Amazon, okay? And they ship those things in boxes, and I can't use scissors to save my life without cutting myself. So a pocket knife is just helpful to open a box every now and again. The problem with knives, though, is they're not infinitely sharp all the time. And so what you have to do is either pay the money to have someone who knows what they're doing do it for you, which, of course, no man in his right mind would ever do, because I'm a man and I'm going to sharpen it myself. Or you have to buy certain products and learn some skills to be able to properly sharpen that knife to the best of your ability. Here's the thing, though. What you're really doing, in a practical sense, by sharpening a pocket knife, for example, is you're not really just whittling away pieces of metal and making an edge which is exactly more precise than the one that was there before. On a micro level, you have these little pieces of metal at the end of the blade, which you can't really see, which get all gunked up and they get dull. And so what you do is you basically properly align those microscopic pieces of metal, which were all messed up like this before, and when they get more into a proper edge, it's just as sharp as it was before you started using it. Now, through that process, there's going to be residue. There's going to be stuff that falls off. There's going to be pieces of microscopic steel which falls off. What that means is if you sharpen a knife long enough, you're going to end up with less metal than you had before. It's a long time, but you end up with less. The application I'm trying to make in a very long, convoluted way is this. I don't weep over my knife getting thinner over time when it's still sharp. Sometimes friends are like that, unfortunately. We want to be good influences. We want to have a positive effect. We want to encourage and enlighten and bolster our friends, the people that we know that we come in contact with our godliness. But sometimes in our lives, using your own wisdom and discretion, it may be more appropriate for you to dissociate with people that are influencing you in a negative way than the positive that you can give to them. Here's a very personal example. When I became a Christian, I was in 10th grade in high school. My social life the first 2 years of high school was a bit limited. People did not like me, and they had no reason to be quite frank. I was not a pleasant person whatsoever. I was rude. I was hurt. I was traumatized by being bullied all the time. I had a hard time dealing with people. And so if I was rude to them first before they were rude to me, then I could just save myself from that hurt that I thought was impending on that relationship. And so when I became a Christian, I knew that I had to change the way that I behaved, the way that I spoke, the language that I used. All these things had to be modified. They had to be increased and had to be perfected. Fortunately for me, I had two very good examples of how to live as a Christian in high school from my two friends. Corey, who is 1 year older than me, I mentioned him before, and Melissa. I happened to marry her. Not Corey, just to be clear. I married Melissa, right? And they were good Christian people in high school who taught me how to change my language, change my behavior, change my overall countenance. But one more thing that I knew I needed to do was completely pull away from my old group of friends. I knew myself well enough that I said, if I'm going to try to walk on the fence here and have 1 foot in my old life and 1 foot in this new Christian life, I'm not going to do either well. And so what I need to do for myself is just disassociate for a while and relearn how to behave in an appropriate way. And for me, that worked well. At the very end of my high school career, I was a completely changed person. It was a genuine transformation. People saw that I had changed, and they were actually thankful and happy to know the new me, which was astonishing to me that people could see that transformation on the outside. And so we look at a passage kind of like this, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of a friend. I knew that I was a sharper Christian because of my friends that I chose to associate with being a good, positive example to me. And because of that, my old friends saw that change, and some wanted to know what was going on with me. And I was happy to share the gospel of Christ. And so, stepping away from this text, stepping away from this concept, overall, we should know that friendship is so special in this world because friends can be used, they can be there for us as tools to overcome the most difficult of times. And if we're not working on investing in those kinds of relationships, we're missing a great opportunity to be stronger in this life. So as Thomas makes his way all the way down from the bleachers up there, we ask the questions to ourselves, looking into the Word of God. We see the blessings of friendship, see the blessings of having a family, which hopefully should be a group of friends that we know better than anybody else. And we see that opportunity. Are we doing what we can to increase that relationship, to increase that dynamic? Because friendship is just one of those things that Solomon discovered on this great search that added a benefit, a positive thing to his life. And I know it will impact our lives in a positive way as well. If you have any questions about what you have to do to not only be a friend of the people that invited you here, but to be a friend of God Himself, we're more than happy to sit down with you and show you in the Word of God exactly what God wants from you and what He will give you in return. If we can help you in any kind of way this morning, please respond by coming forward as we stand and we sing.